the story of the Arab Spring isn't easy to tell. An uprising that began in Tunisia in late 2010 has since rippled through the Middle East, North Africa, and beyond, resulting in the overthrow of long-established regimes in some cases and violent crackdowns in all. The part of the story having to do with digital media has been argued for a while, some scholars and activists arguing that palm-sized electronics and social networks like Facebook played the critical role in getting people onto the streets, while other observers like Yevgeny Morozov and Malcolm Gladwell say the digital collaboration narrative is overblown. But how have people involved with and affected by the revolutions used digital media since to build democracy and prosperity? A couple of researchers took a close look at how Tunisia has recovered and evolved over the last 10 months to find out. Zach Brisson and Kate Krontiris of Reboot are the lead authors of Tunisia, From Revolutions to Institutions. I chatted with them over Skype to find out how digital technology is making a difference. So Zach and Kate, you just came out with a report called Tunisia, From Revolutions to Institutions. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about where this report came from.
Well, we were approached by InfoDev, which is a group at the World Bank that focuses on the role of information and communication technology with regards to governance. And they asked us to take a look at the cross-section of technology and post-revolutionary Tunisian society so that they could understand the points of intervention where governance reform, economic development, and social cohesion could be encouraged by technology.
So take me on a timeline of how, you know, Tunisia has been transitioning since the revolution. They kind of had an uprising early last year, and that kind of kicked off what's been called the Arab Spring. I wonder if you could talk about, like, what kind of led up to that and where it's been going since.
Our understanding of how the revolution came about is summed up a bit in the foreword of the publication. In a nutshell, we think that Tunisia had a revolution because its society had become far more complex than its rulers. And what I mean by complexity in this case, in the context of a society, is the range of possible connections and opportunities within the social structure. So connections between individuals, connections between individuals and organizations, connections between individuals and ideas. Technology has been facilitating the growth of all of those things and creating a vast variety of new forms of connectivity and organization and coordination within Tunisia. During the same period that that's been happening, really over the last 20 or 30 years, as satellite television, mobile telephony, and finally the internet came to bear, you had a governance structure spearheaded by the regime of President Ben Ali, who was very static. They were centrally entrenched in Tunis and a couple other coastal cities. They were very happy in their control of the economy and their wealth, and they had very little incentive to change and evolve with the times. So by 2011, we saw a state of affairs where you had a ruling authority that was far less developed than the complexity of the society that it was responsible for governing. And if we turn to systems theory, there's a principle put forward by a man named William Ross Ashby in the 1950s called the requisite variety principle. And it states that in any system, the controlling authority must be as complex as the system it controls. That's been proven in computational and biological systems, but it hasn't necessarily been applied to social systems yet. But I think if you look at what happened in Tunisia and even the broader region, you can perhaps see that principle playing out, where all of a sudden we got to a state of affairs where the population and the civil society was far more complex than the government of Ben Ali, and a phase change occurred to the system.
I think I would just add to that is a little bit of the sort of national historic and human flavor of the situation, which is to say a lot of the media attention around this revolution was focused on what was happening in Tunis, in the capital, and particularly in the later stages as the regime was overthrown. But this was really a conflict that was rooted deeply in regional disparities that mark Tunisia. And it was a conflict that started much outside of Tunis in some of the southern and western areas of the country, which are places that have experienced sort of long-term structural and institutional disparities. So If you think about, for example, a typical schoolgirl born along the coast of Tunisia, she would live a very different life than one born in the sort of interior regions of the country. She'd be reasonably well-educated, have her health needs met in large part, probably travel over pretty good roadways on her way to school, and have access on par with parts of Europe to technologies that kind of connect her to the rest of the world. Whereas her peer in, say, the rural town of Tala, which is in Kasserine province in the western part of the country, is much less likely to sort of attend school past the age of 10, probably wouldn't expect any kind of response in a case of a health emergency, let alone regular health screenings, and probably lack reliable transportation to basic services or markets. And to be honest, not really consider how a mobile phone could even be useful in her life. So these kinds of disparities are part of the sort of human existence in Tunisia and what largely fueled the discontent, I think, over generations about these particular disparities.
Part of what your report goes into is what the role of ICTs could be in a post-revolutionary society. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how civil society could start to be engineered that would build ICTs critically into the system for participation.
Something really interesting that's been happening is the emergence of what I think we refer to as a digital civil society. What I mean by that is, in a place like Tunisia, where free and open public expression and public organizing wasn't very encouraged before the revolution, people had to turn to other spaces to connect with one another and share ideas. And I'm not even just talking about political ideas, but really anything. It could be a group of teens putting together a club around movies they like. But obviously, you can go up the spectrum and think about groups who are organized around economic opportunity, such as web developers who had online collectives where they would talk about ideas for products and applications they'd like to develop. All of these groups like these were developing before the revolution in virtual spaces online, on listservs, on message boards, in Facebook groups, in mass SMS chains. All of these virtual spaces were becoming real organizing grounds for these types of groups. What happened in the revolution is all of these organized social communities became politicized. It was such a dramatic and mass event that nobody could ignore it. Nobody could not pay attention. And in places where people were already organized and discussing other non-political ideas, their discourse became quickly politicized, and politics became a topic of great interest. So what's happened as the revolution has played out, and now we're in the period after, many of these groups are starting to step into the political marketplace and ask for things that are very similar to what we would look at a traditional civil society asking for. Greater political representation, greater accountability from public officials, more economic opportunities, such as access to growth capital or startup advice. All of these groups are sort of coming out into the new open political marketplace and saying, how can our needs be met? Where can we collect the response from the government that we need to be successful? That's a positive encouragement for the development of a robust civil society. At the same time, because these groups are not coming from a traditional background, they face some struggles that a normal civil society organization doesn't. They don't necessarily have legitimacy or recognition from the international community or groups like the World Bank. They often don't have a physical infrastructure, an office, a mailing address, a place where they can be represented legally as an entity. A lot of times their leadership structures are a bit vague and sometimes prone to internal conflict because they're not necessarily seeing themselves as a civil society organization. Yet at the same time, these groups have the legitimacy and the capacity to advocate for demands that represent broad swaths of the Tunisian public, and I think that's encouraging.
Are there cases in Tunisia where you've seen some of these groups using digital tools to help solve a particular local problem that they're dealing with, or take on a challenge and be entrepreneurial?
one example that came into my mind is actually the sort of TEDx community, which has become a bit of a movement in areas around Tunis largely, but in spread out through the rest of the country. And it's actually really fascinating because what TEDx provides is a kind of like very light structure around how to have civic conversations in some sense. And many of the organizers and volunteers and attendees are sort of young, relatively affluent, but technologically savvy young people who've been tracking using these, you know, technological tools, what happens in other places, particularly around the TEDx community, and are interested in kind of bringing it into Tunisia. And with a couple sort of unifying themes locally in terms of, you know, you hear them talking about imagining history or working in tolerance or how to become a creative genius. There's this sense among the sort of curators and participants that there was a kind of failure of the previous government and other elite institutions, not only to sort of create solutions to economic and social challenges, but to provide a space for civic dialogue. And I think a lot of what you see happening out of this TEDx structure, I mean, it could be, you know, it could have been any organization that puts together this kind of structure, but it's a way of talking about ideas and kind of building the skills and techniques of political conversation in some way. One example of a young man that we met there, I think at the time we met him was about 17 or 18 years old and had basically been tracking these sort of regional disparities in his own way, doing a little bit of blogging on his Facebook when things kind of erupted, was also arrested and interrogated for a couple of days at the Ministry of the Interior, but was sort of fantastically open-minded and ambitious about change for the country. And so I remember him telling us, you know, I've always wanted to travel to Silicon Valley. I'm fascinated by the technology companies that exist there. I've always wanted to go visit those places. And then I realized if all of the talented Tunisians left for Silicon Valley, there would be nobody left in our country to sort of rebuild it. And so my goal now is to bring Silicon Valley to Tunisia. And that's a kind of broad statement from a very young and ambitious person, but he went on to organize a TEDx for Youth conference around a set of not, you know, different issues than we've already raised, but it was exactly that kind of motivating structure that allowed him to kind of feel empowered to kind of take action and be civically engaged. And it was really tender, actually. We sat with him. He said he wanted to show us the video that TEDx has produced. TED has produced for people who want to organize TEDx youth events. And he had memorized almost every single word of this video. He'd watched it so many times. So he was deeply impacted by the possibility of this forum to kind of create change. And it was really exciting to sort of sit next to him and hear him talk about how he views the future.
One other thing that I was reading that really interested me was how pre-existing institutions have been evolving and looking like they're being replaced in post-revolutionary Tunisia. So you talk about, and I'm going to butcher the name here, but the Centre National de l'Informatique, the CNI, which is a technical product development arm of the government that was founded under Ben Ali for technical product development services that relate to government services. After the revolution last year, that institution has been challenged. Is that are like existing institutions like CNI, do they still have relevance like post-revolutionary society, or are they evolving? Are they just completely being destroyed and rebuilt?
One of the hardest challenges that any post-revolutionary society faces is what to do with the pre-existing. So even if you have a changeover among political leadership or at the top of your government, you're still left with dozens or hundreds or thousands of political organizations and other bureaucracies that certainly have vestiges of what came before, but likely also have some embedded social value that deserves preservation or improvement. And watching that transition happen is both fascinating and challenging because there's no easy answers on what should stay and what should go. I think there has been a large push among Tunisian entrepreneurs, other folks in the technology industry, to see CNI take on a new role within the country. instead of having a monopoly over what is a very lucrative market around government IT services, perhaps they could use their expertise in changing their role to being a technical project manager for the government, as opposed to actually being the developers and creators of government software. This would allow them to make sure that vendors were doing an adequate job of serving the government, but also allow them to open up markets that are very attractive to would-be entrepreneurs who'd like to use the Tunisian government as a buyer of first resort, and then be able to take their products and services to other countries in the region. I think another institution of relevance here that is facing similar challenges as it tries to transition in the post-revolutionary period is actually the Tunisian Internet Agency, TIA. This is the authority that has governed and controls internet access in Tunisia and was actually responsible for the monitoring and surveillance programs under the Ben Ali regime. Now, after the revolution, this group knows that it needs to take a different stance towards the public. They recognize that there was vocal groups within the opposition and within the revolution who were calling for an end towards censorship and an end towards surveillance of the populace. Now, every major government in the world surveils and censors its people, so they're not going to stop doing that altogether, but they've changed their messaging, and they've changed their footing. One of the most salient examples is they took one of the servers that actually, before the revolution, was a host to the surveillance and censorship software, and they've turned it into a GitHub for Tunisian developers, and very publicly said, this server is now for the open source community and the work that you're doing. Now, of course, the Tunisian open source community wasn't in desperate need of one more Git server, but it shows the fact that this institution is aware of the need to change its colors and to change the way it talks about its role within the society. The challenge moving forward is to make sure that it's not just a change in message, but a change in action, and I can assure you that there are many committed Tunisian activists who are very aware of that need and are staying on top of these organizations to try and keep them accountable in every means that they have available to them.
I want to talk a little bit about what you've been talking about in the report as, you know, the digital tools that people are going to be using to engage actively in politics. And have you seen anything being employed actively now beyond just technologies that help people engage in discussion? Are there things actually being employed that are kind of for e-democracy?
There's been an unfortunate lack of development of real e-democracy tools. And in this case, I'm talking about e-democracy in terms of touch points and channels for citizens to transact with the government, be those run-of-the-mill daily services or things more tangible around, say, participatory budgeting or political engagement. Part of the challenge is the new government has other priorities at the moment that are understandable. The act of building a new constitution is not easy and does deserve full attention, and it can be difficult to distract the debate towards things like e-government. That said, there are many within the emerging political parties and among these online communities who are clamoring for greater attention to these issues. And I think that they're going to start to see some movement in the months ahead. One key challenge facing many Tunisian government institutions is the fact that there's no law that's been passed that allows for digital records to serve as legal documents. And what I mean is that everything still must exist on paper for it to be legal. There was a law under discussion right before the revolution that was actually going to overturn this and allow for digital papers to count as legal records, but it got lost in the revolution and hasn't been revisited yet by the Constituent Assembly. Practical legislative means like that will constrain the ability of new government services to develop. Another thing that is perhaps constraining the ability of initiatives like this to move forward is that most of the debate in Tunisia right now around the role of government is focused on arguments that have little to do with these practical needs and much more to do with extremist positions around the role of political Islam. You have extreme secularists who are advocating for a completely secular independent government, and then you have extreme Islamists who want to see a government that is far more religious and far more conservative than what's come before. Both of those groups are very well organized and highly motivated and are using technology actively to control the public debate. And they've in fact hijacked the public debate so that these types of issues are front and center in the Tunisian public, despite the fact that most of your everyday citizens, no matter where they come down in the political spectrum, are much more interested in the government actually working for them, providing services in a timely manner, and building the economy, improving the higher education system. Those are the debates that folks would like to see happening right now, but technology is empowering small minority groups to have very loud voices and disrupt the larger discussion.
There's a part of your report under the Social Progress Online section where you talk about a young woman named Fatima. It sounds like she was kind of housebound during the revolution, but she engaged heavily in the revolution online.
Sure. She, like many other actually young women in the country, are really interested in computer science. And so she'd been drawn to computers from a kind of young age, growing up in the town of Hammamet, which is one of the regions of Tunisia that has had a little bit more educational investment. And so she was basically pretty interested in math because her class would visit the computer lab to use educational software as a young person. And she viewed, you know, these computers with a sense of opportunity and possibility. Today, as a sort of young woman in college, and since then, using this kind of technology, text messaging, Facebook, Gmail, whatever it may be, to keep connected with her friends and her family. And she longed to kind of understand something about software engineering and dreamed of developing a kind of new web browser that she and her friends could use to share their online experience with each other. But she found herself getting tired with this sort of course of study. Her classes were a bit boring, filled largely with theory and sort of not so much of the discussion and practice that she was so excited about. This is a trend that we saw more generally in Tunisia around education, is that the pedagogy is very heavily focused on theory and lecture, and that there's a lot of opportunity to expand the kind of experiential learning component of education that makes it so exciting. So she found herself sort of spending more and more time outside of class and organizing student groups to have these kinds of discussions about technology that she was so excited about. And one group that formed was around the open source project Mozilla. And so it's basically a code base that's free and available for anybody to access and build on. And so the folks in Fatima's group used it to kind of practice their skills and would go back and forth with each other, kind of talking about how to get better on, particular aspects of it. And she became pretty deeply involved in it, skipped some homework assignments, we heard, so that she could moderate some of the email conversations. And this was happening really just as the revolution happened. She wasn't really allowed to leave the house, but she was still kind of connected through technology. And there was a lot of discussion, not just about technology, but about what was happening in society on this Mozilla listserv, which had sort of once been reserved for web links and kind of obscure debates about technology, but had since evolved into kind of a rich and thriving political forum in some sense. I think as a result of this experience, moderating technical debates turned her skills towards moderating civic challenges and started reading online about open gov movements in other countries and thinking about how it might apply to the Tunisian context. And she and others helped to organize some events called eTunisia, Tunisia 2.0, to kind of discuss their ideas. And so it's really, it's a really interesting example of how an initial interest in technology was, could kind of be bridged to something that would fit a sort of social situation. So it's young people like her and the young man that I was discussing earlier, who I think, if we can find ways of really enabling that kind of civic activity combined with a certain skill set, that bodes quite well for the future of Tunisia.
I'm wondering what your thoughts on how the infrastructure could be more developed are. It sounds like it's kind of a thorny issue because there's issues of just general infrastructure. You're not getting enough towers in the right places. There can be issues of a kind of a growth of a digital divide where you have the infrastructure in place, but you don't have the tools in the individual's hands. And then there's issues of commerce there too. I mean, who runs these, the infrastructure? Is it a private company? Is it a quasi-public company? Is it just the government itself? I wonder if you could help me tease apart some of those issues.
In particular, I think what we saw was that the landscape in terms of digital infrastructure is uneven. We've seen that two of the three national providers have begun rolling out 3G third generation networks that will be capable of delivering very high speed internet to mobile phones. These two providers also had fairly close ties to the ruling elite in the previous government. So it's unclear whether that service will be widely and homogeneously distributed or distributed sort of along geographic lines that sort of particular to the previous regime. And certainly in the interior parts of the country, internet services are almost completely absent or just at least extremely cost prohibitive. But the point that you raise about commerce is an interesting one. We heard from a number of small and medium-sized enterprises that they're really looking for a high-quality, reliable consumer payments gateway. And the current tool, which is when we were there, is being administered by a sort of consortium of Tunisian banks, was not very usable or secure, and was sort of routinely made victim to malicious attacks. And so the entrepreneurs were looking for ways to access markets outside of Tunisia, but found that it was very difficult to engage in e-commerce. So not only was it difficult to sort of access those markets, but also tampered sort of local innovation. And we're also seeing a desire for, like geographic information systems that had previously been tightly controlled by Tunisia's military. But seeing demand from entrepreneurs and developers and activists asking for that information to be kind of opened up to the public. Again, there are sort of commerce activities that can be built based on that information, and it's also just a sort of useful information generally for the public.
Really, when you look into the interior and you look at some of these issues of regional disparity, absolutely, infrastructure is at the heart of it, but oftentimes it's not really information or communications infrastructure, although those are missing as well. But even basic things like steady electricity and clean water and reliable healthcare are missing. Technology may very well play a role in helping those infrastructures come into play, either by encouraging distance medicine or linking up potential regional entrepreneurs with capital in the markets. At the same time, when you have families who don't have medicine, don't have water, don't have electricity, they're not so worried about whether or not their mobile phone has a signal. They're worried about these more basic human needs. And I think it's a really interesting paradox in that as important as technology has been in the larger social fabric, there are still many, many core challenges that Tunisians face that largely do not have technological solutions. I think one tension that I'd like to pull out, and we touched on it a little bit earlier, was the paradox of new media. And that in a post-revolutionary period, and really any open political marketplace anywhere in the world, we've seen this explosion of participation through new media. And in traditional political theory, participation is a positive, and I still think that it is. At the same time, the ability to participate has been so expanded and the barriers to entry lowered so much that you have participation that is perhaps less valuable than other forms. And I understand that might be a bit of a touchy statement. But if you look at what the average Tunisian voter is facing when they're going and trying to source reliable political information so that they can make a meaningful choice within the political system, they face a vast signal-to-noise ratio imbalance. These are people who've not necessarily come up within an open and transparent political system previous in their lives. They don't have great experience vetting political information and participating in the market. Yet now they have to do it, and they do it amid facing a sea of chaos, of hundreds or thousands of messages coming across dozens of channels, what they're hearing in the local cafe, what they see on Facebook, what they're getting via email, what their family members are SMSing them, what they're seeing on international television, what they're seeing on local television, what they're seeing in the newspapers. What do you do with all this information? How do you sort between it? How do you filter it? How do you decide what you can trust, what you can't, and where to turn to? I think that's a real struggle that folks are facing in Tunisia. And I think it's a bit representative of a larger struggle that political marketplaces all over the world are facing. You can see it here in America. You can see it elsewhere. I don't think we've had a corresponding development of filtration and comprehension techniques to deal with the flood of information that new media is bringing into a political landscape.
That's a really interesting point. I think that And you put this out in the report that this is, you know, Tunisia is kind of, you know, a microcosm of changes that have been experienced all over the world, from, you know, the countries that have been classed as part of the Arab Spring to parts of Europe right now and Russia, and even here in the United States with Occupy Wall Street. There's just a lot of folks who are finding more and more opportunities to participate in politics and have their voices heard and try to make their voices heard. It doesn't seem, it seems like one of the challenges that the system has is keeping up with that. There are a lot of movements wanting to be heard and wanting to have their concerns addressed, and governments just aren't engineered to respond in the way that they're being asked to right now.
Because of all of that, if I had to guess, I would say we're likely to see a period of more social disturbance and unrest in the years and decades to come rather than less. I really think we're only at the front side of this curve. You're seeing these social movements crop up all over the place because you've got a populace who has a set of demands that their governments and their rulers are not capable of meeting. People see a world around them that is live, that's here today, that is far more complex, far more engaged, far more participatory than the options being presented by most governments and by most political systems. And as long as those things are hugely out of balance, I think the period of unrest and disturbance is only likely to grow.
Do you see Tunisia as an opportunity to kind of respond to an overthrow of an old regime and help citizens build a 21st century? I mean, this is like just a catchphrase, but build a 21st century government, 21st century society, and have that serve as a good example for the rest of the world, perhaps?
It's absolutely an opportunity. When we talk about disruption, it can be challenging because it can destroy or alter established ways of doing things that we've come to rely on. There's risk in that, great risk. At the same time, there's great opportunity to imagine, design, and create new ways of doing things that are more fair, more just, and more accountable. That's the opportunity in front of us. That's the opportunity that many of these communities in Tunisia, first linked through technology, very aware of what technology can offer, that's what they're pushing for. They're pushing for a broad reimagination of what the Tunisian system can look like. The challenge that they will face is the forces of status quo are powerful. They were powerful enough to remain even after the revolution. There are many, many, many individuals of influence that had close ties to the previous government, are still in their same positions, and are going to do the best that they can to preserve the status quo. That's the struggle that we're going to see play out in Tunisia, and I think in many other places around the world.
Kate and Zach, thank you so much for being on Radio Berkman today.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Dan. It was great.
Zach Brisson and Kate Krontiris are lead authors of Tunisia, From Revolutions to Institutions, and researchers at Reboot. You can find them at thereboot.org. Zach and Kate curated a nice batch of links for a deeper dive into today's episode. Check them out on the show notes at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. This episode of Radio Berkman is available under a Creative Commons license, so feel free to remix and share and start a revolution of your own. This week's episode was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We'll be right back.